Hello and welcome to Next Week in Your Practice Session. In this session, Bill O'Hanlon joins Drs. Rick Hansen and Ruth Baczynski to give you concrete strategies you can use in your life and work with patients. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist, inspirational speaker, and author of more than 35 books. Welcome to Next Week in Your Practice.
But first I need to acknowledge that this is going to be a little different because Rick was the person that was the expert in the webinar. So Rick, I don't know what this is like exactly for you, but as you look over what we talked about in that webinar and you get a chance to sort of rethink it, what stood out to you most?
Well, it is an odd experience to watch yourself and, of course, read yourself, as other people know. Trying to be a little detached, if I can, though, about my own shtick, what pops out for me were two things. First, the poignancy of the ways in which that this brain is struggling to keep us alive and is therefore biased toward overlearning from negative experiences. And that's poignant. That affects us every day as we go through our day. The other side of it, though, that pops out for me when I step back and look at this material is hopefulness. It's the opportunity to use little ordinary experiences in daily life to gradually take charge of the structure-building processes in our own brain and guide it every day, bit by bit, to a better place. And I appreciate that hopefulness.
Thanks. Bill, how about you? What stood out to you most to you?
Well, you know, people ask me sometimes, why learn about this brain science stuff? What do we care about what's up there? I mean, scientists are learning a lot of new stuff, but what practical uses of it? And I think that speaking to Rick and hearing what Rick said about it, it's like the user's guide, the owner's manual to your brain. We now understand a lot. I'm sure we're going to understand even more things as time goes on, but what we understand now is revolutionary. We used to think the brain was fixed. Now we realize it's not so fixed. That's what I learned when I was in psychology school. Brain got fixed at a certain age, adolescence, childhood. It pretty much got fixed. Now it changes all through life. If you know that, it's really helpful. It can change. Here's the bad news. It sometimes gets stuck in grooves. And what I took from what Rick was saying is you can have the user's manual to the brain and rewire it and change your brain by refocusing your attention and your brain activity in very clear ways. That's what I got from what Rick was saying, so that you can change your own brain. That is why you should learn about brain science and why you should learn particular methods of being a good user of your own brain.
So Bill's talking about the evolution of our thinking about the brain, you know, that we used to think of the brain as fixed and now we see it as something that evolves over the lifespan. Rick, I want to ask you something a little different, but in keeping with evolution, because you talked in the beginning of the webinar about the evolution of the brain, not in terms of over the lifespan, but over the evolution of the species and how the brain has changed. Why do you think that's important, and how can we make that useful when we're each of us in whatever roles we have in our work, as we're teaching other people about the brain? How can we keep that in mind and make it useful?
Yeah, I think the whole idea of the evolution of people in general, but certainly the evolution of the brain, is an extremely helpful and powerful idea. First, it helps you realize that as the nervous system evolved over 600 million years, we're living today inside what is in effect an ancient museum. And we're looking out through the museum at the world with all these creatures and characters and ancient tendencies inside. And so appreciating something about the evolution of the brain, in a funny way, brings us back to ourselves, gives us an opportunity to feel more at home in our own experience and more, if you will, present in yourself, to really include what are, in effect, an inner lizard, an inner mouse, an inner monkey, as well as probably a few other characters, in at least my own inner zoo, that we carry around with us wherever we go. And we can't get rid of these parts of ourselves. They're an intrinsic and important part. So in a funny kind of way, knowing something about evolution helps people become more self-accepting and more inclusive of the different parts of themselves. That's one benefit. The other benefit is to appreciate the ancient tendencies of this brain, which is designed for one thing, which is passing on genes that pass on genes. That's it. That's the fundamental shaper of biological evolution. And so when you appreciate that your brain has these tendencies, it helps you understand them better, and it highlights some of them, like the brain's negativity bias, that are really important to take responsibility for and do what you can about. And then the last thing, I think, evolution also shows us that we've been gifted on the day we were each conceived with this extraordinary organ, to science, probably the most complex object still currently known. And what a fantastic opportunity. I mean, for me, I'm grateful every day for the gift of a human brain. And I have a sense of responsibility. And I think people can take this for themselves as well. What shall we do with this marvelous gift? You know, it's what Sherrington called the enchanted loom, constantly weaving different patterns and structures. And in some ways, we can take charge of that weaving process. And as Bill said just a moment ago, you know, guide it to a really, really good place.
Bill, how can we apply Rick's idea? He talked about the red light, green light idea. What did that bring up in you? Do you have any thoughts on how we can use that?
Well, first, I just appreciate how Rick makes this brain stuff so accessible, you know, with the monkey and the lizard and the mouse and red light, green light. It's so easy to remember when you've got these concepts. And I really love this concept because I think it's really so that, you know, in my work with other people, in my own relationships, if somebody's in that danger zone, red light zone, they're defensive, they're angry, they're fearful, they're not available for whatever discussion or change you want to invite them. I learned this first, again, I was trained as a couples therapist. When someone would come in and the one person would blame or attack the other person, that person wasn't available for whatever change it was. So I learned very quickly, acknowledge and validate. That's the thing to start to calm down those, you know, lizard and scared mouse parts of the brain is just, okay, so you see it this way, or you're feeling this, or this is, but that's not enough, because that other person then might start to say, well, you're taking his side or her side. So it's to acknowledge everyone, if you're in a social situation, and within yourself, as Rick was saying, to acknowledge all those different parts of it. Here's one part of my brain that's freaking out, and here's another part that wants to make a change. And so really to sit with those things without making them feel more attacked or blamed or defensive, that is the key within yourself and with other people. You know, I used to have an arguing style that was a little lawyer-like. You know, I wanted to get my point across, and I realized I would be right, and I would never get anything out of the argument because I would just make that other person defensive or feel defeated. And that red light zone was flashing so much that no change ever came about. So it's really a balance between acknowledging and validating and listening and inviting into some new place. That is the key. And it's the theme that I see running through Rick's stuff, and we have a lot in common. And so I just think, yeah, it's that calming it down and inviting it to a new place. Calming it down and inviting it to a new place, again and again, internally or externally with other people.
You know, it was interesting when you gave the example and talked about yourself, and I used to be right, but what did it get me?
Yeah. I won the argument, I lost the relationship.
Exactly. And how many times do we have to choose between being right or getting what we want? But I'd like to, I'll get back to asking you more, Rick, in a second, but I want to follow this with another question to you, Bill, before we do. How can we help people realize they're entering the red zone and deal with it effectively? Because I'll bet there were a lot of times that you were too busy making your point to realize this is going to be very costly. Or perhaps the motivation to make the point was so poignant only until it's the drive. How do we signal, get people to see the signal faster?
Yeah. I think, you know, I realized it later, like right in the moment I was hijacked by my whatever lizard and mouse brain and even that executive brain, you know, even that executive brain was used to try and be right and win and to dominate or whatever it may be. And so I think when I calmed down a little later, I realized, oh, that didn't work so well. That is, I got my point across, but I didn't get what I wanted, as you said. So I think that, you know, you've talked to one of the people I think has a good model for this, Jeffrey Swartz, who's talking to people whose brains are hijacked by obsessive compulsive thoughts and feelings and anxieties. And he trains them. And again, this is the whole stuff about mind, being mindful, but you don't have to meditate to do this, to just be an observer of your experience and say, ah, I just got hijacked. And it takes some practice to do that. That is not, I think we all have that capability, but it's not an immediately available for most people ability. But over time, you can learn to, oh, there's the red zone. I just got hijacked. I'm hyped up. You know, when my hands start going like this, you know I've been hijacked in a certain way. So I learned to recognize those cues. And I remember one time having a discussion with my partner, and we were in bed, and she said, can you not point your finger? And I had to sit on my hand in order to not point my finger, because I would immediately go into that mode. So I think you can find some external triggers that'll let you know, certain voice tones, certain gestures, certain body postures. And when you recognize those, stop, take a breath, listen more, don't keep going on. I think that's one of the things. And Jeffrey Swartz taught people with severe OCD, obsessive compulsive problems, to recognize, oh, that's my brain hijacking my emotions at this point and my behavior. And I think we can learn that in all sorts of situations that aren't obsessive compulsive situations.
Rick, do you have thoughts on this? How do we A, see the signal of the red zone? How do we care enough to listen to the signal?
One of the most powerful things that I read in the research I did for my book was that being upset feels bad because it's bad for us. In other words, the red zone feels bad. It feels bad to be angry or anxious or sad or ashamed or stressed in general. So one thing we can do is recognize that that's a signal developed in us over 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system. That's Mother Nature's flashing red light. Danger, Will Robinson, get out of the red zone as fast as you can. So that's one thing, is to actually pay attention to the discomfort, the upset, the unease in the red zone, and take it seriously rather than doing what many of us done. I've certainly done this, to kind of plod stoically through life, flogging that little, what Mary Oliver calls, soft animal of the body to keep it going, rather than really listening to its signals. You know, the distress and discomfort of the red zone is an inner signal planted by Mother Nature to get out of this zone as fast as you can. Her plan is for animals to spend a little bit of time in the red zone and get out of it quickly. So chronic stress is really bad for us. So the second thing, I think, is to really build up green zone experiences. Because if you gradually grow green zone experiences inside yourself and you really help them sink in, you will be increasingly able to handle challenges without going into the red zone. There's no end to challenges in this life, obviously, including old age, disease, and death. It's how we meet those challenges that really determines whether we experience stress and the related wear and tear in the body or not. So one of the wonderful things, I think, is to appreciate how repeatedly internalizing everyday green zone experiences, a moment of calm, a moment of pleasure, a moment of ease, a moment of connection with your cat or your friend, is the best possible way, actually, to build up the neural substrates of the green zone so that you can deal with challenges without going red with them.
Thanks. So, Rick, you talked about five factors in neuropsychology: duration, intensity, multimodality, novelty, and personal relevance. How can we promote those factors with each new experience?
Well, the basic idea is that we want to grow the good stuff inside. right? Whatever that might be for a person, maybe more sense of confidence or self-worth or feeling loved by others or feeling attractive or a sense of assertiveness, or maybe we want to grow more restraint, more commitment to sobriety or to just, as Bill said, sitting on our hands rather than wagging our finger in the face of our lover, you know. We want to grow that. Those inner strengths are built out of brain structure. So the question becomes then, how do you grow the good stuff inside your own brain? And that's where the neuropsychology of learning has some very practical things to tell us. That research tells us that structure building, good structure building, is a two-stage process that moves from a momentary mental state to a lasting neural trait. And therefore, if you're interested in growing good stuff inside yourself or those you care about, it means that it's really important to get good at learning, emotional learning, what's called implicit learning especially. So there are five major ways to build up structure inside, and you only have to do one or two of them if you want, and that's how to turn momentary positive states into lasting positive traits. And so I use the phrase mo beta. I guess it comes from my California background. It's easy to get very complicated about all this. You know, in the beginning, it helps to learn different things you can do for yourself. But the bottom line really is mo beta. In other words, more moments in a day, more little episodes where you let positive experiences really sink in and not waste them on your brain. That's good. And also inside any single episode in which you're actually turning a momentary state into a lasting positive trait, try to deepen the experience to get more of those neurons firing together so they're wired together as well. And I think for myself, I use a dozen seconds. That's kind of my takeaway. If I can stay with an ordinary positive experience, a sense of inner strength, maybe a sense of inner peace, perhaps feeling loved, perhaps feeling more loving, perhaps feeling accomplished that I got something done, or I'm having a nice sense of connection with my two friends here in this interview. If I take a dozen seconds or so to kind of marinate in the experience, to help it last, to also help it grow in my body, to deepen its multimodality, that factor, or even let it be more intense, I have confidence that just doing that naturally, since neurons have fired together, wired together, is turning that experience into something of lasting value for me. And that's all it really takes. Yes, mo beta. You know, the more often you do this and the more you engage all the factors that turn passing mental states into lasting neural traits, the better. But to know that, you know, a handful of times every day, half a dozen times or so, kind of on the fly, less than half a minute at a time, that's less than 5 minutes a day. But bit by bit, you really can be growing these good things inside yourself every day.
And Bill, on a similar theme, because I think this is really important, Rick mentioned about how biased the brain is toward the negative learning and more weak when it comes to positive learning. How can we, you know, knowing that, what can we do?
Well, I think Rick already talked about that a bit, and I used to teach positive psychology quite a bit, and I was in Australia teaching a workshop, and someone said, oh, yeah, you know, I was talking about gratitude, and he said, yeah, I'm a psychology professor, and I have my students do an exercise I call 25 gratitudes before breakfast, and I was like, I would never get to breakfast if you gave me 25. He said, no, they're simple ones. You know, I get up, I switch on the light, and it comes on. And I get up and I turn on a tap and water comes out. I have a roof over my head. And I thought, oh, I could do 25 of those. The things we take for granted, which is one of the things the brain does. Once it's there a lot, we get used to it. We don't notice it. The good, as Rick said, we're not taking it in, partly because we don't notice it. And it's those things. If you just went through a hurricane, or if you're in the East Coast as we're recording this and the lights are out and you don't have any heat, you know, you don't really appreciate that until it goes away. But if you can deliberately orient yourself to what you have that you've taken for granted, that's a really good thing that sometimes even kings and emperors 500 years ago didn't have. You know, I have this amazing Skype thing that we're talking on that I can talk to you in a different part of the country. That's incredible. 25 gratitudes for breakfast. You can make it 5. You can make it 3. You can make it 10. Whatever you want. You do need to get up and have breakfast eventually. But I think that's a great habit to get into. And it sets the tone for the day. As Rick said, you start to reorient your neurology, your brain, your attention to the good rather than just the negative. And that gives you some resilience even when the negative comes during the day.
Take good care, everyone.
Thank you for watching this session. We hope you'll go ahead and take these ideas and begin using them in your work. In part 4, you'll find your Quick Start Guide. It's an at-a-glance reference to the most critical concepts and practices from this short course. You'll be able to use this to refresh your memory so you'll feel confident in turning these insights into action. And in part 5, you'll find the transcripts. You'll be able to download, print, and refer to these professionally formatted transcripts as often as you like. Thanks again for watching.